Today is August 9th, 2012, and we are at the headquarters of the Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewerage District, MMSD, in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And our program today is a talk with Mr. Charles G. Wilson, formerly of the MMSD staff and the USGA Green Section staff and many other exploits in the turfgrass world. And as people talk, I'd ask that they introduce themselves in their voice so that we know who's talking when and can look back at that and map it by who said what when. That would be helpful for us at Michigan State. Mr. Monroe Miller, retired superintendent and currently ambassador of the Wisconsin Turfgrass Association, will be asking a lot of the questions, particularly as they relate to the Wisconsin side of the industry, with Charlie today.
Well, Charlie, I think a question a lot of people would be interested in, I know you lived in Wisconsin for many years. Where were you born and raised?
I was born in Port Jervis, New York, in a riverside community on the Delaware River. My folks lived in a little town of Eldred, about 20 miles up the river on the Delaware River. And my father had a grocery store there, and it was a summer resort section. There were a lot of boarding houses that took care of people from New York City. We were only about 90 miles outside of New York City. And we stayed there until my father sold the store and went to work for the A&PT company. Then we moved to Scranton, Pennsylvania, from Scranton to Philadelphia, and from Philadelphia to Washington, D.C. I think I'm going into too much detail.
Maybe. Oh, that's, yeah. You're fully an East Coast guy.
Yeah, but, yeah, that's true. Then most of my growing up years were spent in Washington, D.C. We moved there around 1930, and I stayed there until World War II came along when I enlisted in the Navy, and I served almost 4 years in the Navy. I was in motor torpedo boats. I always say my claim to fame was Jack Kennedy was my skipper for a little while.
Oh, man. Wow. Isn't that a piece of history?
So that was when we were still back in the States. And then I spent time in Panama and then, of course, overseas in the Pacific. And starting, we had a shakedown training center on the island of Tobago. It's just off Panama City, in Panama, of course. And then from there, I went, spent about a year there, came back to the States, then went out to the Pacific, farther out in the Pacific to New Guinea, and then from there up the islands and ended up in the Philippines. And from the Philippines, our squadron participated in some of the battles there. And then we went to Borneo, where I think the last invasion of World War II took place. It was done by the Aussies, yeah. Australians, and we just served some patrol duty along the beaches and so forth, the motor torpedo boats. And then the war ended, and I came back to the United States, and I had never figured I would go to a university because during the Depression, we didn't have that much to work with, as most of you know. But I was able to get my lousy high school records and take them out to the University of Maryland, and they accepted me, and so then I became more studious. In fact, I was taken into Alpha Zeta, which was an honorary agriculture fraternity.
Yep. That's quite an honor.
Yes, it was quite an honor. And then, from there, I figured that maybe something in turfgrass, because my first job, other than the GI Bill of Rights, was in the spring of 1946, I guess it would be. And at that time, I was looking for something more to do. And I'd been out to Rock Creek Golf Course and had played a round of golf there. And then as I came out, I was on 14th Street, which is a very nice neighborhood in Washington, D.C. And just, I don't know what occurred to me. I stopped the car and then went up to the first house that I came to and knocked on the door. This lady came to the door. And I told her that I'm a student at the University of Maryland, and I was looking for some sort of work taking care of lawns, and I was studying agronomy. And she said, "Oh my gracious, do you want some more customers beside me?" They hadn't had anybody all during the war.
Oh, sure, all the boys were gone.
Yeah, so it was love at first sight, I guess. So anyway, I ended up hiring a couple of other fellows to work for me. And I paid them $1 an hour, and then I figured, well, I better learn something more about turf grass. The University of Maryland didn't have anything going at that time. But they suggested I go out to the plant industry station where the United States Golf Association, Green Section, had joint efforts in turf grass research. So I went there and went up to the office and told them who I was, and I would like to get some information on turf grasses. They said, well, our information goes back to 1920. So they had a little extra office there where they kept a lot of their research papers and Green Section record and various publications they had made way back to the year 1920. And they said, well, you can't take any of them out, but if you want to look at them here, well, that's fine. So I couldn't go that day anyway. I went back a couple of days later and went in, started reading these pamphlets, and I did that for, oh, maybe a week or so. Dr. Fred Growl, who was then in charge of the Green Section, was out of town, and he came back and he saw me sitting in there, came in, introduced himself, and asked how I was making out in reviewing these early bulletins. And I said, well, I've reached the point where everything that had been done up until now was thought to be wrong, and they were kind of starting all over again. In the early days, if you used ammonium sulfate, that was about all you needed. If you got the soil acid enough, the weeds wouldn't grow. You're familiar with all this, of course, Monroe. So he said, well, you know, we've got some summer jobs out here working on the turf grass plots. Would you be interested in doing that? And I said, well, how much does it pay? And he said, 87 cents an hour. Now, I was already paying two guys $1 an hour, so that made a lot of sense. But anyway, I took the job. And that's how I got into the turf grass business.
Charlie, where was that? You said
that was at Beltsville.
It was at Beltsville.
Beltsville, Maryland. Okay. That's where the turf grass plots were located. I have no idea whether there are any still there now or not.
But was that USDA and USGA?
And USGA.
Both of them. And, yeah. And Dr. Growl was with the Green Section?
Yes, he was with the Green Section.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Just as an aside, I'm curious, were you ever aware, probably not, when the plots were at the site of the Pentagon?
No, I was aware that they were there, yes, uh-huh. Before the Pentagon was built, but this was after the war and after the Pentagon had taken.
Oh, okay, it was already up.
So I never saw the Arlington turf grass.
Arlington plots. Turf Gardens, that's right. What I was thinking about,
Yeah, that was B.C. before Charlie.
Well, continue. It's fascinating. I didn't mean to interrupt you there, but I was just curious if that was Beltsville.
No, that's fine. So anyway, so I worked for the Green Section about 20 hours a week in addition to going to the university. And I did that all through college. And after I got my degree, Dr. Grau asked me if I would like to stay on as their extension agronomist at the time. And
Did you get your degree in agronomy?
Yes.
In agronomy.
Yes, it was still in agronomy at that time.
So it emphasized plant growth and
yes.
crops, and yeah, yeah. even though it wasn't a turf degree, a lot yeah. of those basics.
Our first textbook was Horticulture 1 was the Victory Garden Handbook.
Oh, for heaven's sake. Wow.
They were even short of
yes.
yeah, wow.
books in those days.
For heaven's sake.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, I got a background in horticulture, but I was in the agronomy department that I got my degree. And then I went to work full-time for the green section. And about a year after I had gone full-time working for them, Joe Dye, who was the executive director of the United States Golf Association, he felt that what we were doing in Washington, D.C. wasn't what the member clubs really needed. They needed somebody to visit with them and discuss their turf problems and see what they could do to help them. So he asked me if I would be willing to go west with him and introduce a new service for the United States Golf Association. So, of course, I said yes. And we started out in California and then went to Oregon and Seattle and Denver, a series of meetings that the local United States Golf Association represented organized, where we had a little introductory meeting and I told them something of what we were about to
sure.
do. And as a result of that tour, Joe Dye, who was as executive director of the Green Section, he was far above Dr. Grau
oh, yeah.
as far as the organization was concerned. So Fred Grau didn't approve of it, but anyway, the Golf Association did.
I'll be darned.
So they sent me out to California to open the first Green Section office. And I did that, and I got out there and after the meetings, and Joe said, well, as soon as they sign up and send us the money, this the country clubs we're talking about now.
What year was that, Charlie?
Hmm?
What year was that about?
46.
About 1950?
47, 48, I guess. Let's see how. We came back in 55. No, it was later than that. It was about 51, I guess.
Okay.
1951. And anyway, I got out there and there was nothing forthcoming from all these clubs that were going to sign up for the service. So I said, well, I've got a wife and a young baby here, and I better see if we can promote
sure.
something by personal
some
visits. So I just offhand started visiting clubs.
Huh.
And of course, we didn't get them all, but we got some. And that's what started the Green Section service. And later that was had grown to several regional Green Section directors. I often told people the only thing I really directed, I didn't have any employees, was my car down the road. But so anyway, I called on clubs and learned more from them than they did from me. But anyway, it was kind of a happy occurrence at the time. And O.J. Knorr, who was my predecessor and the man who hired me, was a graduate of the University of Wisconsin, and then he also almost got his PhD there. There was a couple of things left, but he, like me, needed to go out and start working to get some money, you know, because this time it was getting close to depression times, I guess. So anyway, he was the one that hired me, and how I met him was through turfgrass conferences.
Oh.
So when I got out there, one of the first things I did was start a little newsletter for the member clubs to kind of keep them up to date. There wasn't much source of anything in those days. And let's see how that evolved. Well, anyway, I figured, well, it would be nice if some of our local golf turf superintendents and turfgrass associations, they were starting up in those days, if they would like me to see if I couldn't get some speakers together that had already been traveling nationally to come out and see them. So they said, sure, give it a whirl. And that's how I got to know O.J. better.
Oh, sure.
Because I lined up O.J. and Tom Mascara and a few other of the traveling agronomists in those days.
Charlie, at that time, was O.J. doing somewhat similar to what the Green Section was doing? Would he visit clubs individually, or is he dealing with his distributors? How was that working out?
Yeah, all of those things. All of those. Yeah, but Milorganite history is really very fascinating. We hardly ever mentioned the name of the product, you know, mm-hmm. Because in those days we were interested in turfgrass, and that's the way O.J. started it. I mean, he didn't go out and pound the table, mm-hmm. you know, trying to sell. He just did actually. It was an interesting story. At one of the earlier conventions I went to, it was after the sessions were over, and we were having a few toddies down at the bar, and O.J., there were maybe four or five of us. The others were superintendents. And, you know, there were four or five superintendents and O.J. and myself. And so O.J. said, well, we had to go someplace or other. He picked up the check. And one of the superintendents says, oh, wait a minute, O.J., if you think you're going to buy my business by buying me a drink, you got another thought coming. O.J. says, fine, you pay the check.
Well, that is a good story.
Yeah, right? So anyway, then he got up and left. So I took the check from the superintendent, and I told him, I said, well, you shouldn't do that. You know, O.J. has no, you know, intention at all. And anyway, we talked a while, and I met him a couple of other times, and before he left, he bought a carload of Milorganite.
I'll be darned. A carload.
Yeah. Well, that's how we sold it, yeah.
You know what? And I can remember unloading our carload at the Nacoma Golf Club down at the West Washington train yards.
In Florida, you know, long growing season, heavy feeding Bermuda grass. Boca Raton used to get three carloads a year, 50-ton carloads.
Wow.
So
wow.
Florida was a big market for us.
Wow.
Yeah, we had all the leading clubs there. But with O.J., you can only spread yourself so far. But I followed in suit what he did. We would go and attend a local superintendent's meeting. They'd have us say a few words and show a few slides about turfgrass mm-hmm. problems that we had run into. There was one in Cincinnati one time, the greater Cincinnati, Ohio superintendents, I forgot exactly what the name was now, but it was August, dog days, yeah. And I took a bunch of slides, nothing but turf that was dead or almost dead. And I was showing these slides to the superintendents, and after I finished, this one guy came up and he says, you made my day. Huh. He says, I've got all those problems. And it's really nice to know I'm not alone.
He wasn't interested in seeing slides of green grass. Wow.
I digress very often.
That's all right.
Yeah, it is. Absolutely.
So anyway, so I set up a series of meetings, and of course I got in touch with O.J. Norton, Tom Mascara, and a few other people. And asked them if they would be willing to help us out with these new organizations that we're just forming to come out as part of a tour. I arranged it so we could make various stops along the way. And they all said sure, you know, and came. So they gave their talks before the superintendent's organizations or the turfgrass association organizations. And that's how I got to know O.J.
Oh, yeah.
Quite well. And then when it was getting close to the time that he was thinking of retiring, he got in touch with me and asked me if I would consider going to work for the MMSD in representing Milorganite. Hmm. And so I talked to my wife, of course, and we decided that probably would be a good thing. I didn't think that the green section offered really much chance for advancement. You're pretty much stuck in a good job, but that was the case anyway. So,
and you were still in California at that point?
Still in California.
Was that in Davis?
That was Davis.
That was Davis.
I never wanted to locate in Davis, but Fred insisted I did because he said the university will give you office space, which they never did. I would be much better with all the traveling to have been in San Francisco.
Oh, you know? Sure.
Okay.
But anyway, I digressed again. So let's see, where were we?
Is Marion your wife, is she Marion, a northern girl?
She's from Canada originally.
Oh, so the thought of moving to Wisconsin wasn't
it? Yeah, I met her in Washington, D.C. after, I was still going to the University of Maryland. It was a blind date. The sorority she belonged to were having a dinner, dance, annual party, and through school chums of mine, one of the gals belonged to this sorority, and she asked me if I would like to have a date that a steak was involved, so that's all I needed. Yeah. So that's how I met Marion.
Oh, my darn.
And, so anyway, O.J. Hired me, had me come back here, and he showed me the plant, everything was Jones Island in those days. And I was fortunate that he hired me anyway. Then in 1960, you want something about the Knorr Foundation now?
At any point, and at your pleasure.
Anyway, 1960, he officially retired. So I came back in 55. And so I had been understudying O.J. and learning what I could of his wealth of knowledge. He was really a brilliant man. Some of his leading distributors, Chicago was a large distributor, Philadelphia, there were about a half a dozen of them. And they said, well, we ought to do something for O.J. because of what he's done for us through the years. So they came up with the idea that they would raise a fund and have he and Judy, O.J.'s wife, make kind of a world tour with ocean trips and so forth, and end up somewhere along the line in Norway, where his folks came from originally. But O.J. got wind of it, and he told them, he says, in no uncertain terms, he said, you have done for me, not what I have done for you. So he wouldn't accept it. Mm. So the Chicago distributor, Oscar Borgmeyer, talked to me about it, and he said, well, we want to do this for O.J., and he wants no part of it. So can you come up with any thoughts of what might be done? And of course, immediately, turf research was going strong in Pennsylvania, it was strong in Rhode Island, and a few other places. It was just starting schooling with Love in Wisconsin at that time. So I said, well, would you distributors be interested in raising money for a foundation that supports turfgrass research? So, there's nothing wrong with that. So why don't you, see if O.J. would accept it? So, of course, he accepted it. And that's how the the O.J. Knorr Research Foundation started. In fact, the first project was with Love
at
Wisconsin.
Nutrient deficiencies in turf grass.
Yes, and Golf Magazine, which no longer exists, they Herb Graffis agreed that if we got the article, the pictures together, he would publish it. So he did, in full color, and it showed the effective lack of minor nutrients on turf grasses.
You know, that some research was so interesting, that ended up in Beard's first book, those same color pictures.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know, it was a real, you'd think, my gosh, surely by that time, something 1961 or 62 or whenever Jim Love did that, that surely you would have thought that would have been done.
Yeah.
Hadn't been.
Yeah.
And those two guys, or three guys, Charlie and Jim Love and O.J. Knorr, yeah, what a great project, and Doc Beard put it in his book.
Yeah. And, okay, so now we've got the first research projects going. We raised enough money to do that, or I should say the distributors contributed enough to do it. And then I'm advancing quite a spell of time. Beard, first off, when O.J. retired, he had all this literature, and I had a full complement of the USGA green section bulletins and prior works too, because I worked for the United States Golf Association green section. So anyway, I got together with Jim Love, and I said, Jim, I've got all this material that should have a good home that O.J. told me to, gave it to me when he retired. And I said, do you suppose the University of Wisconsin would be interested in this? I mean, it's the first thing of its kind going. And Jim said, well, he'd look into it. So he came back to me and said, they would be interested, but they've got a few qualifications. They could not take the project on unless they had money to support it. And what kind of money, I asked, and they said, well, we probably need some sort of a research person to you know, document all the literature and slide files and all the rest of this stuff. And anyway, it was something that the Knorr Foundation just didn't want to take on at that time. They had already contributed quite a bit of money to the Knorr Foundation. And we're continuing to under my reign. In fact, I was worried about the fall off in contributions, so I asked them nicely if they'd be willing to contribute a quarter a ton price, you know, to the Research Foundation. And some of them did. Fortunately, all the big ones did. So we had then a good source of income, and that's how we got the project started at Wisconsin. But anyway, the board said, well, you know, we can't commit ourselves to that forever, and it's just too much for now. So then Jim Beard comes to town to give a talk to the Wisconsin Golf Course Superintendents Association. And he had never been through the plant, so picked him up at the hotel and brought him over, took him through the plant, and then we went back up to the office, and we had a large, well, not that large, I guess, but like a double office in lengths, where we had a big long table where we looked over the slides and literature place, and I showed Jim what we had in there. And Jim said, well, what's going to happen to all this? And I said, well, we had hopes that the University of Wisconsin, that's OJ's school, would take on the listing and keeping of it, but we had to tell them no because they wanted too much. Jim said, would you be interested in Michigan State having it? So I said, sure, you know, it's a good home. Everybody could have access to it. And of course, you made it now, so everybody is using it, I guess, all the time. Supers are using it. And so that's how it got in Jim Beard's hand. And then I went over and presented it to the to Michigan State. And that's how the O.J. Knorr Research Foundation materials ended up in your hands.
Some of us from Wisconsin could be bitter about that, that our land-grant college didn't have enough vision to see that it should have been there. Well, but however, we couldn't be happier with where it is now.
I've heard that rumor. Yeah, that's true. And it had been, you know, maybe 5 or 6 years later, it would have changed.
Or a different administrator who could see what the value of this was going to be and its potential, but it didn't happen. But thank goodness it ended up at Michigan State.
Yeah, and then when Jim left Michigan State for Texas, he started another library down there. So.
Indeed.
Indeed. So anyway, how's Jim these days?
He is doing, both he and his wife are doing remarkably well.
I know he had an awful time with sickness for a while.
He has been up and down over the years and keeps coming back, and they're both still active, and he is still writing and collecting and lecturing and comes to visit, and of course his collection, all his personal materials are now at Michigan State as well, alongside the Norm materials, so it's really become a great fit, honestly. It's worked really, really well.
Well, we're so happy for it.
Charlie, could you tell us a little bit about O.J.? I mean, there's a gap here. Mm-hmm. Jim Love would be one, but there aren't too many. I mean, I never met the man. And, you know, I'm getting kind of up there in years. And I would be curious about just a few things about him. Was he tall? Did he have a deep, vibrant voice? Was he bashful? How did he gather and garner so much respect from so many people? Just talk about O.J. a little bit.
O.J. was probably the first traveling agronomist that visited golf courses. Now, in my time, he would go to Philadelphia, we'll say, and there'd be a superintendent's meeting. So he would give a talk and show some slides there. And at the same time, because we never had that much time when you're covering the nation and the islands and everything else, you know, Caribbean islands I'm talking about, to stay very long in one spot. He was on the road probably 3 weeks out of every four.
Oh, my.
For most of his life, I think. And Judy told him once during a vacation, you know, that he had to stop all this traveling. And this was during the Depression days. And she said, O.J. tells me that he told Judy, he says, well, Judy, you know, the times are tough. And it might be easier to get a new wife than a new job. So he had a wonderful sense of humor. Although I'm not sure Judy appreciated him at the time. he had a good, excellent speaking voice, and there was just something about him. Now, I attended, even when I was with the USGA in the Beltsville area, I still was. O.J. put me on the road, not O.J., but Fred Grau put me on the road a bit, and I would run into O.J. At that time, too. But I can remember one time in Kentucky, Fred Grau was, he was an evangelist, I guess we would say. Okay. But he would go to a golf course and say, well, you're overwatering the grass. And that's the reason you've got so much poa annua here, annual bluegrass. And what you need to do, if you want my advice, is to kill off all of this and start over and plant Marion, Kentucky bluegrass in those days. And whereas O.J. Knorr would go look at the golf course, and it was being overwatered, and he just had an inherited sense that this superintendent is not about to change his practices to benefit a new grass. So rather than that, what can we do to give him a grass that likes a lot of water? And that's where Poetrivialis came into the
act. Oh, for heaven's sake.
Shade bluegrass. In fact, when we were doing some overseeding studies in the South, we were using ryegrass, of course. That was common. Speaking of carloads of Milorganite, those courses would use carloads of ryegrass to overseed. So we put a series of plots out throughout the South, and this would have been probably 1957, something like that. We had plots in Atlanta, Georgia. We had them at Boca Raton in Florida. Where else? We had them. Well, anyway, to make the long story short, we used a series of different kinds of grasses. We used the rye grass. We used bent grass, red fescue, and Poetrivialis. And Poetrivialis, because of this work that we did in the field, it wasn't true research, but I mean, we're demonstrating to superintendents who would come and visit the golf course how these various grasses looked, you know, as overseeding. Well, Poetrivialis was the winner because it germinated fast. If you use Kentucky bluegrass, you know, it took a couple, 3 weeks before you'd see much of anything. The ryegrass was fast too, but Poetrivialis was much finer leaved, and the golfers liked it for putting. In Atlanta, we were at East Lake Country Club, and I put in some of those plots. And the pro there liked the red fescue better than anything, creeping red fescue, because it just made a better, faster surface for them to putt on. Although in those days, on a public course, everything was 5/16 of an inch, or a quarter at the private country clubs. Now they've shaved that down.
Tenth, more or less, if you can imagine, Charlie.
Yeah. So that sort of work we did. We put out fertilizer plots. In fact, one of O.J.'s favorite mythologies was that a lot of new things seemed to be coming on the market in those days, and superintendents were interested in whether they should use them or not. They would contact us, or I should say O.J., to get his opinion of it. But he was always a step ahead of me. He had plots out at the various country clubs of these new materials that came on. And his method was, well, here's what the manufacturer suggests. So we'll use that. And then we'll go half that rate to see if we can get by with less. That's a savings in money, maybe. And then we'll double up on it to see if we can cause any damage. Very simple demonstration. And I think many superintendents do that today.
That is correct.
Trying something new.
You bet.
Yeah.
And I think O.J. was the first to do that.
Was he a big guy?
No,
he was not.
He was about my size, and I'm a short guy. Well, not my size now, maybe. But
but he wasn't physically imposing.
You know, about 5'8".
Oh yeah,
like that.
But he certainly had the respect of the golf course superintendents he called on.
Oh, he really did. He really, really did, yeah.
Was he the generation of your father?
Yep.
He was, okay.
Yep, he was my, he and my father were both born in 1890.
Oh, I'll be darned.
Okay.
Wow.
My father preceded him in death. He died at age 72, where O.J. made it to 75, age 75. Yeah, he had only one daughter. That's what all that travel does, you know.
You know, and actually, when the Wisconsin turfgrass industry conceived, developed, and built an ag research station for the University of Wisconsin, Madison, we wanted to name it after O.J. Norr, but we had to, who do we get permission from?
Yeah. Mary Carter.
From his daughter.
Yeah.
And she flew from, well, you were probably there.
No, I didn't.
She flew from California to Milwaukee and sat at the table during the luncheon. Mm-hmm. And at that meeting, Andy North was our guest speaker, and he had just mm-hmm. won the U.S. Open at Oakland Hills. Mm-hmm. But she was so flattered that ag research station was named after her father because mm-hmm. he was so interested in science and this kind of research.
Yeah, we tried to get her to see if we couldn't get her to attend one of the O.J. Knorr Foundation
sure.
meetings, but we were never able to swing that. But no, I didn't get to that. I wanted to, but I was off someplace else prior
sure.
commitment.
Charlie, so when you, certainly during O.J.'s career, he traveled by train.
Yes.
Did you do much of that?
Yes.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. Yeah, it was really, you know, you could leave Sunday night, and for a big swath especially the Midwestern area, uh-huh. Be there bright and early on Monday morning to go to work.
Oh, yeah. Then you'd have a distributor meet you, you'd rent a car or something?
Sure, yeah, well, the distributor would meet
distributor
us.
Meet
they
you.
Were happy to take us around.
Wow. Did you function pretty much like O.J. did then?
Yes.
Kind of followed his back.
It seemed to be a winning situation. There wasn't much reason to change it. And as far as visiting the country clubs, O.J. would visit, he'd go to Philadelphia Country Club and a couple of others, whatever he could do conveniently in a half a day or most of a day, and then he'd be on to the next stop. In other words, in those days, you wouldn't go to Philadelphia and then come home and then go back
oh, sure.
to Washington, D.C. Or New York. You'd make it all in one trip.
He was out for a week or two, probably.
Yeah.
Well, I'll be darned.
Yeah. Huh. Yeah. Well, I was, too. My wife said she was a grass widow.
A grass widow.
Yeah. Fascinating times. O.J. was a great guy. Well, you know, people said he drank a lot. He really didn't, but usually at the time of the national convention, mm-hmm. Everybody was trying to buy him a drink, and a few times then he probably had one or two more than he should have, but he always was up and ready to go the next sure. morning.
Charlie, how do you pronounce his name?
Ovan Ewell.
Ovan Ewell. No. He never went by that.
No.
Always O.J.
O.J., yeah.
I'll be darned. Yeah. And a Stoughton Farm kid.
Born
of Norwegian immigrant parents?
No, his father was a M.D., a medical doctor in Stoughton,
yeah.
Wisconsin.
Yeah, okay. Just outside of Madison, Norwegian community.
And that's where O.J. was born. So he was from this country, but his I'm not sure whether his father or somebody else before his father came from Norway over here. Probably his father did as a youngster. So
oh, yeah, sure enough.
So he had parents that were here.
But his name was different enough or exotic enough that he always liked the initials.
I don't know why. Uh-huh. Those things happen. I know I had a friend, Z.T. Hamilton. It didn't stand for anything. The Z didn't stand for anything. The T didn't stand for anything.
Huh. I'll be darned.
So during these trips, obviously somebody had a camera, or more than one person had a camera. So how did those pictures become, and later the motion pictures, how did that become such an important part of the whole cycle and the lecture circuit and the process and taking those pictures, because they are such a tremendous legacy and record of what happened and where over a very long period of time? Did he always carry a camera or
always,
two?
Always. And he would take almost always three pictures of everything. Again, like the turf
sure.
research.
Have stop above and below.
One below. Right. Yeah, shoot high, shoot low.
Yeah,
shoot
different
high.
Stops.
Yep, yep.
Yeah, and when I came back here, let's say that 55, it was about that time that he got interested in movies.
Okay.
And he made up movies and then showed those at the National Superintendent's
Convention. Oh, for heaven's sake.
So did he stop using the still pictures?
No.
No.
Never
so he did both.
He had a leather briefcase he carried that was filled with him, weighed a ton, you know, with movie cameras and film and slides and whatever.
Okay.
But no, he was the first to make movies of turf grass. And in his travels, almost every golf course has something of interest to show you, you know. Either a problem or something they're proud of, you know. And superintendents often have both going at the same time. So as I told you about Kentucky, that one guy saying, "You made my day. You showed nothing but dead or dying grass."
And most of those slides are now at Michigan State?
I think so.
Most of them. And we're still looking for ones that aren't there or that appear to be missing.
I don't know. Shortly after I went to work for MMSD, well, maybe it was a year before O.J. retired. O.J., oh, I'm sorry.
You're fine.
Get it all fouled up?
No, you're fine.
O.J. Hired another agronomist, Jim Latham. Did you met Jim?
Absolutely.
Never? No, never did. You knew
Jim. Oh, I knew him very well, yeah.
And he was the other agronomist, so two of us to try and do the work of O.J. We probably needed 10, but anyway, we both took pictures, and O.J. of course did too, until 1960 anyway. And then the movie film, in fact, Jim and I put together a film. Do you have those?
We have a number of them. We haven't done anything with them yet, but we do have a number of films. Yeah. Yes, 16mm, there's some 8mm films in there as well. Yes.
Yeah, do they carry voice with them?
Some of them have voice tracks. Yes,
I got in trouble with the one that that I made up with the you remember Gene Nutter? Well, you remember the name anyway?
Yep.
And I was taking pictures of various turf things, and Toro came out with a new putting green mower that would mow on a slant. Remember the collar as well as the green, so anyway, it was brand new, so I wanted to get a picture of that in action on the movie. And I put down a keychain that the superintendent had to distinguish something or other on the grass. And anyway, it was a Toro mark. So, of course, everybody that was a Toro distributor loved it, and everybody that wasn't hated it. I was accused of advertising something which I had no intention of doing. But anyway, it was there on the movie, so Nutter told me that any future movies that we might make, and they loved the movies, the superintendents did, but we would have to clear it through his office before we could show it, so.
Charlie, you mentioned Jim Latham. Did O.J. hire Jim, or did you?
No, O.J. hired him.
O.J. hired him. And he was working for the green section also, wasn't he?
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I first met Jim Latham at a turf grass conference in Tifton, Georgia. Dr. Burton, who was a Nebraska boy and president of the Agronomy Society and a well-known plant breeder, started out with Tifton 57 and Bermuda grass. That was an athletic field turf. You couldn't use it on a golf course, but it was a growing grower. So, so anyway, where was I with
O.J.? You and Latham had worked for the green section.
But I don't know. I always felt he was a wonderful boss. Probably he didn't didn't get after me too much. Maybe that was the reason, but no, he really was a good friend. And when I came back here at first, my wife and then we had had another child. She was in Canada with one of her aunts while I was getting organized back here. And OJ and Judy, they took me under their wing, invited me out to their house for dinner several times. And got me located in a hotel at first while I was the old Medford Hotel, downtown Milwaukee. That wasn't air conditioned, and that summer of 55 was a scorcher. I don't know whether it compares with this one or not, but anyway, yeah. So, no, he was very, very thoughtful.
So you kept taking pictures even after O.J. retired and Jim shot pictures?
Oh, yes. I kept on until I left them.
Okay. Yeah, the ledgers go up through 74 is where that break point is.
Let's see. I was there till 79 I retired.
Okay.
Things were starting to change with Milorganite. I thought we could convince the sewerage district that we needed to do more with homeowners because we were really, probably 75% golf courses and athletic fields, and most of the time I was there. But I shouldn't talk about my unhappiness. I guess that has nothing to do with it. But I retired. I took early retirement. It's part of a story, I guess, when the commission decided to put a skull and crossbones on the Milorganite bag.
Oh, my gosh.
And why was that, Charlie?
I don't know what year it was. It was 78, maybe. Anyway, there'd been some objection to the heavy metals in Milorganite.
I didn't know that.
And they never asked my opinion of anything or whether I had any, rebuttal from turf grass researchers, and I knew I could line up a few anyway. But I didn't care for that at all. I guess I had another reason too. I was in Florida and distributor there at the time was Charlie Mascaro. That was a brother of Tom Mascaro. And he had a little short course that he had built, and it had two lakes on it.
This is a great story.
And when I went to Florida, the one in his area, they always had me stay at his house. So I'm out looking at the lake. I'm not only out looking at them, I'm fishing in them. But anyway, this one time I was down there, this one lake was clear as a bell, and the other one had a few weeds and algae in it. So I asked Charlie what he was doing here rather than there. And he couldn't think of anything, and he says, he says, I know what it is. He said there was a... You mentioned the public course. I can't think of the name of it now. But that was the time when we started seeing divers with their gear on, the helmets and everything, picking up golf balls from the bottom of the pond, see? And they were taking movies of this at this golf course for a picture. I never did find out what the picture was. But anyway, the producer, the director, or somebody said, the lake isn't as pretty as we'd like it to be. So they got a material called lake dye, dulges. That doesn't sound quite right. But anyway, they put some of this in the water, and it turned it a beautiful blue color on this golf course. And so the director was happy with that, He looked prettier on the screen, of course. So the Doles, that was the name of the product, Lake Dye. It wasn't a lake, it was a dye, so put it in water, use it in fountains and so forth. They had no idea that it would also control weeds. And anyway, Charlie said, well, yeah, I put some Dole's lake dye in this. At one of the meetings, they gave each of us, I don't know, a gallon of it or whatever it was, to try it out and see if we liked it. Mm-hmm. So he says, that's the difference. So, you know, shade.
Fantastic. Shade, yeah. That's why there were no weeds there.
Yeah, shade. Well, it won't stop the rushes and things that are already out, of course. Mm-hmm. It has to stop new things from germinating. It's a beautiful algae control. Anyway, I started talking about it in Texas, maybe too much ahead of time, but anyway, my older brother died some number of years ago. He was at Loose Ends at the time, and I told him about this, and I said, I think it's, you know, we could get a patent on the thing. But I said, I can't run the business. And he said, well, how about me? So you probably met Bob at a conference or two, but he didn't
more likely
anywhere near long enough. But anyway, so I got some money together from distributors and to start the business. I named the product. And Bob did all the work in getting somebody to put it together.
And the name of the product was?
Aquashade.
Think about that.
That's
incredible. I never knew
so
that.
So I had something to fall back on with leaving MMSD, the Milorganite folks.
Can you imagine this day and age, how many golf course ponds don't use a colorant of some description? Almost all of them.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, you see it every once in a while in fountains.
Mm-hmm.
They dye the canal down in Chicago green for St. Patrick's
sure.
Day.
Yeah.
And anyway, we sold some in Thailand and just all over the place. So then, let's see, it was 1994 that we sold the business. My brother died, and then his wife took over the merchandising of it. But anyway, we got a pretty good price for it.
Outstanding.
Yes.
And maybe if we'd been younger and kept it going a little longer,
sure.
I don't know. Should have a tremendous market.
Oh, I mean, it's...
It lasts for a long time, an amazingly long time. I thought at first, you know, it would be something you'd have to put on like a fungicide, you know?
Yeah.
But, no, even in Florida, why, twice a year would keep them weed-free, algae-free.
Well, did you read in the news recently, Charlie, that they dyed the entire lake of Lake Dalton, Wisconsin?
No, I didn't know
that. Because it's the water skiing and the weeds are bad. They had dyed the entire lake, $30,000 worth.
How'd it work out?
I think good. Some people are wondering if they shouldn't have been fixing roads instead of dyeing the lake.
Yeah.
But recreation's their whole business up there. It's a Tommy Bartlett water show and everything. But that's a good-sized lake.
Yeah, I remember the Dole's folks got in touch with me at one time and wondered about what, this material was that controlled the weeds. Oh, we had studies going at Indiana, we had them at several different universities, research stations, where they tried to kill ducks. And
oh, I see. Fish probably.
The toxicology
birds.
Side of it, yeah.
Yeah, we turned a few tails blue, but...
mm-hmm. That never hurt a duck, did it?
Hey, Charlie, can you tell us about how the Wisconsin Symposium started?
Oh, yeah, the Wisconsin Symposium. We, let me see now, how do I want to start this? For many years, we had no distributor here in Wisconsin. We took care of Wisconsin on our own. And I made the switch to having a distributor take care of it, because we have so many, in those days anyway, little mom and pop hardware stores and, you know, places that sell fertilizer.
Sure.
And they'd come down to Jones Island to pick up, you know, 7-8 bags, some of them, or, you know, they were just getting in the way. They were underfoot.
Yes.
And we were selling 50-ton carloads, you know. But anyway, we had a weigh station. We had a guy to weigh the material anyway, to sell it to them. But that's another story about my changing that. But the superintendent's meeting, this one was held in San Diego. I forget the year. But we went out to San Diego. Jim Latham was with us at that time. And O.J. was no longer here, so it was after 1960. But anyway, in San Diego, and we, at that time, would have the golf course superintendents from Wisconsin, this area where we distributed. We never included you, Monroe, in those luncheons or dinners. But anyway, we had the Wisconsin Super, where we acted as our own distributor.
Mm-hmm.
Cy Graham, who was with us at that time, he used to take the local superintendents out for dinner one night. So anyway, when Jim and I were out there, there was something about, there was no way to get a bar service but go to the bar in the hotel. Well, by the time we got the bill from that, it wasn't just superintendents from Wisconsin. It was salesmen and ladies from Timbuktu and every other place, you know, that were having drinks on the O.J. Knorr Foundation. So fortunately, it didn't go on very long. Drinks were cheaper in those days, so I never got fired for it anyway. That's how the Turfgrass Symposium started, because on the way home, Ray Leary, who was then the chief engineer and general manager for the MMSD, the top job, he would always go to the national conventions. Okay. We would invite him to that, and the middle organite would pick up his expenses for that. So on the way back on the plane, I was with Ray, and I talked to him about it. I said, this is terrible, and it just isn't right either, because others are wondering, why are the superintendents in Wisconsin getting this attention? It wasn't that much, but some. And why weren't they, you know? Jealousy, I guess. I don't know. So I said, O.J., and where we are not, you know, where we have no distributor and we handle the golf courses direct, I, of course, was very interested in research and what was happening in those lines, you already know. And I said, what would be wrong with our having a turfgrass symposium here where we make it a point to talk about Milorganite? So superintendents, I didn't know much about the product, and we're buying carloads of it, you know. It worked. It turned the grass green.
Mm-hmm.
Another aside, there was some work done in England many years ago where they measured the biological activity in the soil, and where chemical fertilizers were being used, it was at a certain level, and where manure was used, it was way up, you know, roughly the same amount of organisms, but under organic growing conditions, they were much more active, so they gave off much more methane and whatever gas that was measured. Had nothing to do with Milorganite. It wasn't Milorganite search, but of course it tied in beautifully with a sales pitch anyway. So Ray Leary said, fine, sure, go ahead, set it up. So we had a meeting with a couple of the local superintendents, and I gave them my idea of what we wanted to do. And I said, we'll take care of the speakers coming in, as their expenses and so forth are concerned. And there's going to be a charge for it. But anything we raise over and above, we'll take care of the charges, but anything over that, why, you'll donate to the Knorr Foundation. So that's how that happened. And that's still going on.
Oh, my gosh, quite strong. I was going to ask you, too, I think I remember this correctly. Fred Grau came here as a speaker once, didn't he? Or was he just in attendance?
He was here. I don't know. No, Fred was never a speaker at the...
He might have been in attendance.
At the symposium. I don't know when that would be. But Fred... I don't know. How much of this is going to be publicized?
I would... Fred Grau is such a, has such a long history in the industry, going back, another Nebraska farm kid as well. Yeah. Back into the 30s and through the green section and out of the green section, and so heavily involved in the sports turf side of things. But I have always heard that he was a really strong personality, and...
He was. There's no question about it. I never finished that story when I said he was an evangelist,
Okay.
But O.J. always took the practical side. And that trip in Kentucky, Fred's talking about this and that and this grass and that grass and a whole bunch of superintendents. And O.J.'s lagging behind the group, and all of a sudden O.J. stops. And somebody noticed that he had stopped. He's looking at the ground, at the grass or something or other. And that whole group quit Fred Grau abruptly and walked back down the hill to O.J. I thought that was classic.
Yes, story.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Because he really was more help to the superintendent than Fred ever was. Fred liked to walk in, I guess, higher circles, I don't know. He was friendly with superintendents. I don't mean that. I don't, he's agnostic about it, but... But anyway, that's another story about how I came to disagree.
The reason I asked that was this, Charlie. A number of years ago, I took all of the programs of the symposium and composed a roster. And the roster was like a who's who in the turfgrass industry.
Yeah.
Anybody who was anybody spoke at the symposium.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it's still the only true symposium in the country, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, single subject?
Single subject.
I'm pretty sure. Yeah.
We said it was going to be a single subject, so.
Yeah, take a subject and work it over with the people who are best qualified to do that.
Yeah. That's the way you should do with school.
True. Yeah. Well, so you had a very productive career, obviously a very rewarding career.
We were very lucky. I never had a year, a fertilizer year, which, the big season is the spring.
Mm-hmm.
But we worked two different sets of books, that the sewerage commission was on a regular calendar schedule, and the fiscal year was different.
Oh, sure.
But with the fertilizer sales year, I never had a year where we didn't sell everything we produced.
I even heard, Charlie, that at some years it was rationed.
Oh, sure.
Where you couldn't...
Sure, distributors always wanted more.
Distributors always wanted more, yeah.
How much were you selling a year back then, Charlie?
Hmm?
How much, what was your tonnage that you sold?
It was, I think my average was over 70,000 tons a year, about 72, something like that.
Wow.
When the dryers were all reconditioned, that was a big year. Maybe it was 80,000 tons,
wow.
And that gradually came back down to.
We're about half of that now.
But 70, yeah, 35.
To 40.
40? Wow, I thought it was 55.
Well, it was.
It was. Yeah. Well, it's tough to break into a retail market.
We've had a lot of industry that has left town. There's been some other things.
Yeah, it's changed the product.
Well, certainly the quantity of product. We don't have as many industry anymore.
And the nitrogen has dropped a little bit. What do you guarantee? Can you still guarantee 6?
We do 6-2-0 in the pro market, and we do 5-2-0 in the retail market.
Oh, okay. So it's still good. It's the world's greatest fertilizer.
It is?
It is.
No question about it. As I say, golf courses don't like the fact it stimulates earthworms, but they're the best aerifiers in the world.
That is true. Yeah.
Charlie, what were some of the, did you have some unique products? I remember coming across some old literature when I saw
milcyanate.
And
we used to control crabgrass with it. OJ brought that into the market. And I tried to get a mixed fertilizer going for the garden trade, but the sewage commission voted it down.
Oh, you mean a complete fertilizer?
NPK? Yeah. In fact, they did. Ray approved my getting a little mixing plant, you know, to make some experimental mixtures. And of course, milorganite is a great material to soften the heat of some of the potashes and chemical salts. In fact, the first milorganite was sold to people that mixed fertilizer together, use it as part of a mixture.
Did the soils testing lab operate the whole time that you were working?
The soils lab?
Yeah.
Oh yes, OJ started that. Yeah.
Well, I think before he started milorganite, he was a Wisconsin State soil scientist, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
If that's the correct phrase, is that right? I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, I don't know how long. OJ, much his work in Wisconsin with milorganite, of course, at first was with crops, you know, corn,
yep.
Wheat, oats, barley, vegetables, and made a great showing. OJ always said that Dr. Truog, mm-hmm. Gave him credit for steering him toward the lawn business, the golf business.
I think Emil Truog was his major prof.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. I met him.
Yeah, tough old German.
Yeah.
Brilliant scientist. Yep. I always thought that was so curious. Emil Truog, you know, never got a PhD.
He never did?
I didn't know that.
Well, neither did OJ.
And he was chairman of the soils department. When the Soil Science Society of America had its international meetings in Madison in 1960, there were people from around the world lined up in the hall outside the main office of the soils building waiting their turn to get in and meet Emil Truog and say hello to him. And that was OJ's major professor. And somebody asked Emil Truog, why did you ever get your doctorate degree? And he said, who would be my major professor? So I think it didn't impede his career. And I think that maybe some of that, possibly, maybe OJ saw that.
No, he could have gotten his doctorate.
He had everything done, I think,
except
almost
the writing. He had everything done, but he wanted to do something else. And then, of course, he came back here in 1926, and he started traveling immediately. And he just never
happened.
Found the time, I guess, to do it.
Well, it wouldn't have been important to him.
Yeah.
Wouldn't have made any difference in what he was doing, probably.
No, at that point.
Yeah, but at that point in time.
It would have been nice if he had gotten I tried to think that maybe they'd give him an honorary doctorate, but they wouldn't.
Well, considering how...
probably.
Considering how they handled the library issue, it's not surprising they would have screwed that up, too. Can you tell us a little bit about where you got the Green Section Award? What year was that? That was the early 80s? Or was that in the 70s?
Yeah.
I should have looked that up. I can't quite remember.
O.J. Noor got one of the first ones, but the MSD had two people that got the Green Section Award. And
O.J. was one, and you were the other.
I was the other one.
Yeah.
I think of course, I guess you'd call it, I pioneered the foundation, and I opened their first regional office.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I had a reputation for belonging to a lot of local associations, turf grass associations. I think there was something like 18, or was it
Sheepers.
Something like that at one time. So anyway, they were aware of it, and the people in the green section that I knew well were still there too. Fred Growl was no longer there when I got it. Gosh, I can't remember.
Well, Pete just gave me this. I'm sure he's probably got one
okay.
for you.
82. Okay.
82.
How about that?
Down in, is it New Orleans, did it say in there?
That's when I was good looking.
You're still good looking.
How about this? How about something like this? Who's that guy?
I better put my glasses on and see who he is. Well, that's Fred Graham. No.
No, it says, no, it'll say on the back there. That looks like Fred Grau, though. That's the first thing my staff said was, that's Fred Grau.
Oh,
I said,
yeah, the superintendent.
You need to look closer.
Yeah. We had superintendents that would use the Milorganite bags. They'd get caught. I mean, the workers, you know, would get caught in the rain or something and wouldn't have any rain gear. And they'd make a rain suit out of Milorganite bags.
How wonderful.
Yeah, 100 pounds. Well,
100 pounders. Oh, my gosh.
Burlap.
Yeah. Is that right? Yeah. Do you have any of those in your archives?
I never remembered that. Yeah, Parsons was a superintendent in St. Louis.
Yeah, exactly. Algonquin,
okay.
I think.
Yeah. I remember Algonquin.
Yeah. Is this in your yard? I don't mean to jump ahead. Is that you? And is that where you lived? Is that your house?
No.
No. Okay. You don't recognize that one.
From the slides.
Yeah, somebody named Wilson. So.
Wilson rolls newly laid sod.
Yeah, that's not a real helpful
description.
Now, if you don't recognize it, then we'll try and.
I don't know.
Okay, that's definitely you, though.
No question about that.
Yeah.
I'm pointing at something and I can't see what it is.
Well, unless it's
seeded with Highland bent grass.
Okay.
And sodium arsenite. You remember that, Win Monroe?
Oh, sure.
That's how we used to burn off all the weeds. Huh?
Yeah.
And potassium cyanate was another one.
And you had these box experiments, apparently?
Oh, yeah. This was at Brynwood. We're treating the fertilizer plots. We had quite a series of fertilizer plots going. Another interesting thing about Milorganite, even under putting green height of cut, it stayed in place, whereas the chemical sources of nitrogen would run.
Yep.
Interesting. Maybe that's the reason the Milorganite plots always looked the best. It kept the fertilizer on the
stay
plot.
Put, stay put. Thank you.
They're those wonderful. Yeah, great. Yeah, USDA. Anyway, I think that was the reason that the green section told the executive committee that they'd like me to get the green section award.
Because of the pioneering with the green section itself, first
yes,
guy.
Yes, yeah.
First guy.
In their first office.
Mm-hmm. It is quite a piece of history, Charlie, when you think back on it.
They didn't.
Back that far.
Yeah.
That program is so strong now and has been. For so long, that's now, you know, the main way the green section is recognized in the field is certainly by the, you know, the regional agronomists. That's the face of the USGA.
Yeah.
Well, I was lucky. I was there during a great rain, you know, where Milorganite was very popular.
Did you know anything about black and white pictures that O.J. may have taken? This would have been before you were around.
It was almost all color in my time.
Okay.
But some of his early work, of course, was black and white.
Right.
With the vegetables and things. You don't have any of those, huh?
We don't. We do have some vegetable material, but we have what, not a lot.
Or mixtures.
But some remarkable early golf course pictures. And it was like the later color slides, it was equipment and diseases and cultural practice. It was across the board, but it's black and white material, the negatives, and they're superb. They're even earlier than the slides. And the slides, you know, practically, it looks like he adopted Kodachrome in 1938 or so. So a lot of that pre-38 material that we have is not a lot. It's very little, but clearly there was a lot more that were taken just because of the numbering and the way they're blocks of them, and then there's nothing, and then there's another block. They're spectacular images, honestly, that predate the slides. But if you didn't work with those, then...
No, I didn't. Yeah, I was with O.J. when he started the movie film.
Okay. And how are the slides used? I mean, how...
Well, O.J., of course, used them. Mostly, O.J. would... He didn't often go back... to get old slides to show at the meetings. Try and be current with them. I guess we did that too. Jim Latham used them, and I used them. Almost every meeting we attended, we would have slides with us to illustrate various points. The first big inventory we had of them, we lost a bunch of them. We had them on racks in this little alcove on Jones Island near our office. And one of our engineers' son worked for us one summer part-time. My son worked for Milorganite part-time one summer while he was going to school. And so did my daughter work part-time. From the Sewerage Commission. And anyway, this lad, one of the engineers' sons, was putting slides back where they belong because it's, you know, that was a job we had him do. And the whole thing upset. It must have weighed a ton.
Yeah,
you know?
That's
fortunately,
right.
It didn't kill him, or I guess it didn't really hurt him even. But it broke a lot of slides. Heavy case fell on. So that's where we lost the big first bunch. Jim Latham, I think, I don't know whether Lois still would have any or not. It might be worthwhile to get in touch with her to find out. But I think he took a bunch of them with him when he left because he was still, you know, calling on golf courses.
Right.
He was back with the green section again.
I did get a box in the mail from Jim.
Oh, okay.
Some years later, he returned them. He returned them again. A nice sleeve of ones, obviously, that had been missing at some point in time. Yeah. Yes.
Well, he was still with the Sewerage Commission. He had me come down and take a look at him. And I don't know. It was just a jumbled mess, you know.
That's the way slides tend to get.
Yes.
Yeah, they sure do.
Yeah, it's a shame that first set ever upset because probably they would have been. And we had listing of the slides.
Yes.
Did you get any of that?
Yeah, we do have the what we call the ledgers.
Yeah.
Which are spectacular, of course.
Yeah.
Because they're so helpful in terms of the level of detail, you know, and those are just sample sheets from them. And they're all that yellow, oversized ledger format. Who wrote all this down? When Nor took pictures, how did he go back after the fact, or when you took them, I mean, did you just keep all this in your head? Because, I mean, the level of specificity is, you know, so amazingly high that, well, was it years afterwards or a week when you get back?
When O.J. Was doing it himself, he, there was no inventory of anything.
Okay.
And I was the one that started.
Well, thank you for doing that, because otherwise...
And a lot of these were research on the overseeding plot.
Oh, sure.
Where nobody had ever thought of poetry to Ellis until O.J. came along for overseeding. Bermuda Greens.
Yeah, without that level of detail, we would be... Even though there are some on-slide annotations,
yes.
These are certainly more extensive than what can fit in that little frame.
See, this is East Lake priceless. In Atlanta. Yeah, I did all of that overseeing. Capital City. Yeah, these are
That's
all
wonderful. So some of the slides, we have some puzzles here for you. Which may be really...
Quiz time, Charlie.
Maybe pushing your memory here, but some of these are color-coded. Do you happen to remember what the color coding might have been? So, for example, you know, most of the slides
look like
silver
this.
Sleeves.
Yeah, these are mine.
What we called standard silver, and you cut and mounted... I heard a rumor you cut and mounted a little X-Acto knife or something, mounted all those.
Oh, yeah. Nights, weekends.
Oh my gosh.
Whenever.
Those are wonderful. But then there are occasional ones that have these color-coded frames around them. Well, and we have never found a key to the colors.
Well, these are OJ slides, I'm pretty sure.
Okay. So was this do you know if that was for a program or?
I think it was a kind of tape they had.
Oh, okay, which it could well be.
As that, huh? Yeah.
Well, very possible. Because we have not been able to figure it out.
No, I don't think it's any significance.
Got it. Thank you. That's very helpful.
Yeah.
And the ones that are dash D, because there's a lot of dash D, like this one's a 1027 dash D. We have assumed that was duplicate of some kind. It was not an original.
Where's the dash? Oh, here.
Because many of the slides are dash D's as opposed to the primary numbering. Does that sound familiar?
It should. I did the writing of some of these, of course, many of them, most of them probably. Now, these are older ones, 46.
Yeah, those are...
51.
I like your theory about the color of the tape, because we haven't been able to figure that out. So I like that explanation.
And it's always D.
No, well, so, no. I mean, most of the base numbers are not D's, and we assume that's an original. And then the dash D's we assume are duplicates that were. You know, they were made from the original.
Have you run into that? That sounds reasonable.
In many cases...
One duplicate?
Yeah, if they were even, what do you call it? They're cropped versions of the larger hole.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that for some purpose somebody tried to blow up and get more detail.
Mm-hmm.
Or it's just you send them out and pictures, you know, they get... Two or three duplicates made to use one and or give it to somebody or loan it out. Was the material loaned out to people?
I mentioned the first catastrophe that I'm aware of. O.J. never took any slides with him, and he never came back even after he had left to get slides for any purpose.
Okay. Because they do appear, you know, the photo credits, courtesy of, you know, MMSD, do appear like in the USGA turf books, the 52 and 62 Musser textbooks, you know, have a lot of pictures that are courtesy of MMSD.
Oh, okay.
And so we're going to try and go back and figure out if those were slides or other pictures, because those were all in black and white.
I've got you. I'm sure OJ, because he took most of the time three pictures of everything, he may have given some of them away. Oh.
to we don't see the three, you know. Sometimes we do, but normally there's one for each event or what
subject or whatever.
Which subject? A shot. You know, sometimes there's, you can tell that there's the one high or the one low, but a lot of times those are not there, and one was, it looks like it was picked out of the best ones, mm-hmm. and that's the one that went into the system, as it were.
Yeah. I don't know whether you've ever heard the story about Kodachrome grass.
Tell me more.
Well, Kodachrome lies a little bit. It makes everything look a little better, a little greener, a little brighter than the other ones that were on the market at the time.
So,
It really does.
Okay. Because there is some ektachrome in there. There's some agfachrome. There are some, but mostly it's all Kodachrome. And we're trying to do the color mapping with the film types. And, of course, you have to use different filters depending on the film type. And we've run into some that appear to be Kodachrome, but most of the Kodachromes are either, because you remounted them, we can't always tell what the original film stock was. And that's proven a little bit challenging.
That's true. Now, what was the other major one anyway? We always liked Kodachrome. Yeah. It was prettier.
Well, it holds colors.
It's like Blu-ray on the television.
Looks good. It looks good. It does look good.
And the movies.
When was the last time you were over at the Turfgrass Information Center,
to
Michigan
where?
State, over at Peter's Library?
It's been years.
Long time.
Okay.
Yeah.
You'd really be surprised.
I've been retired for 33 years. 50. Something like that.
70? Good.
Yeah. I took early retirement.
When did you leave, Charlie? 1970?
79.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Well, you need to come over and visit. That's for sure. You really do.
You'd be real proud of it. It's impressive.
Oh, I'm sure I would.
It's just staggering.
Yeah, I found a good home.
Yeah, and I what ought to make you feel good? Well, that one, the last time I was there, two summers ago, and I think you were out of town, and I was just chatting. Just the place is just a beehive of activity. They aren't all full-time employees. A lot of student help and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But now you correct me if I'm wrong or if I'm exaggerating, but I remember someone saying, I think if you count everybody, the part-time workers and everything, there might be 40 people here.
Different people, with the students,
students. Not they weren't there at that time,
right,
but there were lots of them.
During the year, we can have 25 students, 30 students. Yeah, so
that's what you got started.
Yeah. That's great.
It's just awesome, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, Beard deserves the credit, of course, because he's the one that.
Yeah.
I was still hoping that Wisconsin would, you know, Love would be able to accomplish something more in getting them interested, but
there was some luck on the other end as well, because apparently when Beard went to the then library director, who he had been trying to encourage to collect turfgrass materials, Dick Chapin, his father-in-law. Chapin's PhD was from Champaign and the University of Illinois. And it turns out that Chapin's father-in-law was a soils guy, soils prof at Champaign that had done some turf work. Mm-hmm. And so Dick Chapin knew what turf was when Beard came and said, here's this turf material, how about it? And so there was some fortuitousness at that end.
Well, I know it's grown tremendously. We just got a very minor start for it. You know?
Well, it was the start, though. And, of course, there are still all the original norm materials that are there. Mm-hmm. And materials that you solicited, you know, I can see some of the paper trail. later on to have donations that came as a memorial and became part of the Knorr collection. And of course, those are still there. And that took work that would not have been done anybody, honestly, unless you had done that. So thank you.
Yeah, it was a great contribution, Charlie.
Yeah.
That and then symposium. Still going. Still the only one in the country. One subject.
That's great.
It's just...
Yeah, a couple of times I've been asked to go to it, but something happens or something. My wife has not been physically perfect for some number of years, so we seem to have a lot of trips to doctors and things,
sure.
So she no longer drives.
Well, sometime or other we ought to have you come up and... It's at the American Club. It's the most comfortable, place.
I've been there, not to stay overnight, but
really
you know, just eat lunch.
Yeah, if you can imagine. The symposium is held at the
I've been invited by, who's it, Jeff?
Jeff, sure.
He's gonna
he asked me, I know, one time if I would come up to it. But I don't know. Once I got out of it, I decided I'd be it's better off if I stayed out of it, you know. I didn't want to be a hanger-on, I guess I thought.
It's a little like Jim Love has done the same sort of thing. It's like pulling teeth to get him. We got him to our field day 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And I tell you what, former students, they're my age, and we're old guys,
yeah,
lined up for a long distance. Got a golf cart for him because they wanted to talk to him again.
Yeah.
And so I tried to get him last year and again this year. He said, no, it just spoiled the memory of that great day I had 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And he had a top on the cart because of the sun. And a place to sit.
Yep.
And people lined up hither and yon to talk to him. So, but I understand, he's the same way. He said, no, next generation's taken over. And he's busy playing bridge and whatever other things he likes to do.
Sheep's head.
He's a great card player. Yeah, gee whiz, those guys playing cards at noon in the sales building, who could forget it?
I play Sheepshead every Tuesday and Thursday from 5 o'clock to 7 o'clock at night.
Well, you know what it's all about then.
Wow, that's wonderful.
Oh, that's great.
I picked that up in Wisconsin.
That's our card game.
Yeah. That's right.
So did you live for any time in Florida, or were you always here?
I'm always here.
Always
with
here.
Middle Oregon.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
And always at Davis. Well, I was only, what, out there 3 years, something like that. I didn't, when O.J. hired me.
Well, yeah. An interesting life. I always like to tell, I think I mentioned this to you. I may be the only person who knows this little bit of trivia, but Port Jarvis, that's the home of Ed Sullivan.
Oh.
Now, I mentioned Ed Sullivan to my kids, and they don't know who that is.
Yeah, he was Mr. Television for
Mr.
a while.
Mr. Teller, Ed Sullivan Theater, that's who's got that, his late night shows from the Ed Sullivan Theater.
David Letterman.
Yep.
Delaware River there is still a wild, great river.
Oh, gosh, Charlie, you come down that big hill from New York down into Port Jarvis there by the... Oh, it's just breathtaking. It's beautiful. Just beautiful.
Yeah, I've done a lot of fishing there.
Sounds like you were a fisherman.
Shad fishing. Well, I don't know whether... I guess we've pretty much covered what little I know.
How about we go get something to eat?
Okay.
Thank you so very much for sharing.
Well, indeed.
You're very welcome. You do me great honor to, have
me come. No, we appreciate your time and your insights and all the things you did over such a long period of time.
Well,
we'll be working with this material for years to come.